And I've often wondered, you know, what does it take to conceive of a piece of music and to be able to conceive it in advance of writing so that you have a sense of what it's going to be? Obviously, you never quite know how it's going to end up. But shall I move this closer? Is that the thing? Do you think I'm hearing... Oh, right, I'm hearing... Maybe I can hear the music of the spheres. There's something going on anyway. Everyone happy? Great, okay. Maybe that was the croissant making that noise. I mean, you know, obviously you could ask it of any outpouring of human creativity. And you can never fully appreciate what it is unless you've actually had to work at trying to do it yourself. You know, a poet who can maybe write a sonnet that is a very particular form, and there are rules and conventions that make something a sonnet. And, you know, somebody can spend weeks, and maybe, you know, the classic sort of caricature is, you know, you spend you know, a whole day looking at it, and you add a comma, and that was your work for the day. And yet that comma could transform the meaning. I mean, you know, the mind boggles. And for those of us who don't do that sort of thing, it's very sort of remote and difficult to understand. My mother is a painter and has always painted and is still painting. She's 80 this year. She's still painting and making sort of bits out of driftwood and stuff and sticking them on other bits of wood. And it's all quite random. And my parents' home is just full of bits of wood, stuck to bits of wood. And it's all marvellous, obviously. But, you know, sometimes you think, well, why? Yeah, well, but particularly with music, there's something so extraordinary. I mean, music in itself is the most abstract of art forms there is, isn't it, if you think about it? Obviously, there is abstract painting, but it's still of something, whereas music is completely and utterly abstract, especially if it's without words. Maybe the kind of music you really are into and you appreciate is song, and that is obviously the most popular and global, and often is more accessible, although not necessarily. And you know, music that is without words, particularly for a whole range of different instruments, and maybe goes on for a very long time, seems very inaccessible and difficult to conceive. I mean, basically, you get some of the great symphonies of the last 150 years or so. You know, they might last over an hour of just solid music. There might be little breaks every 15 or 20 minutes or so, but you're not allowed to clap. You're not allowed to breathe. And if you go to the loo, you're never coming back in. All these sort of conventions. And it's very difficult to get your head around what's going on. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are intimidated by classical music particularly. Now, there are lots of different types of music I could talk about today. I am going to focus, well, actually just focus on orchestral classical music without words. but I could have spent, you know, all the time focusing on another genre or area. But I guess if you think about the work involved in writing a symphony... and until basically, I don't know what, the last 25, 30 years, you had to do it all by hand. Now you can use a computer, and there's software like Sibelius software or whatever, and you can do just in a flash what might take a day or a week. I mean, it's extraordinary. But, you know, until relatively recently, the labor involved in writing, maybe, say, for a full orchestra, 5 minutes worth of music. I mean, you might take several days to do a minute. So what sort of person invests that kind of effort into writing little black dots with lines on in particular places for hours and hours? You know, some might look at this as they look at any artist and creative person and see it's total self-indulgence. Why should we pay for that person just to sort of sit there and do what they want? Whereas actually, I think I would argue it's the complete opposite, because it's incredibly costly to do that. not just on your backside, but also just in terms of the effort and the isolation required, usually the silence required, to conceive of this, and then painstakingly, line by line, instrument, voice by voice, to conceive of and then put on the page what is going to happen, so that when they all come together, you don't have cacophony, but harmony, even disharmony when it is there intentionally. That actually that is a gift. It is an act of extraordinary generosity, I would say. And because it is so labor-intensive, I think it's incumbent on people just to give it the time of day, even just to sort of give it a moment to try and figure out what is going on here. The difficulty is, in this kind of era, everybody assumes things will be immediately accessible if they're good. And that if you have to work at something, it's just not worth the time. And so, you know, the ideal pop song, it's got a hook, it grabs you, you like it, you hum it, and you want to hear it again. And, you know, there are lots of things going on there in the 3.5 minutes or whatever it is. And the genius of great pop song writing, and it is genius. You know, not, very few people can actually do it well. But the genius is to compress into those 3 minutes a world. I mean, the Beatles were, you know, masters of it, but many others. Beyoncé is a master of it. There are all kinds of things going on in those just few minutes. But the thing is, if you just rely on immediate accessibility to be able to figure out what's going on, then you will be missing out on 9/10 of what is out there, more. And I think of it sometimes, it's best to think of it as like a language. I mean, if you have never spoken French, you can't just sort of pitch up at Calais and start talking and expect to be understood and to understand. And if you're a typical Brit, you just shout. That'll make it worse, by the way. No, you would assume that in a different country, in a different culture, there are languages, there are customs, there are just activities you need to learn because they're not familiar to you. And I would say the same is true of any art form, whether it's abstract expressionism in, you know, 20th century American painting, or the modernist novel with, you know, the unreliable narrator, or whatever it is. Jazz or modern dance. I remember being taken to a Ballet Rombert by a teacher, and his wife was actually one of the principals in Ballet Rombert, and it was all modern. So they'd rejected, or they'd moved on from some of the classical ballet stuff. And, you know, I was completely lost. But it was fascinating because at the halftime, this guy's wife came back and explained to us what was going to happen in the second half and gave us just a few things to hang on to, and it changed everything. Suddenly we had just one or two things to look out for that made sense of the whole thing. And that's, in a sense, what I'm going to try and do with music here. Because otherwise it is just like a foreign language that you sit and it goes over your head and you think, I don't know what's going on here, and frankly, I don't care. Well, I hope that will not be the end point of this. Because I think that actually there is a point to what a composer is seeking to do, even if you don't fully understand their language, even if you don't understand the context or the forces they're going to use, or you know, the purpose for which a piece is, you know, composed. It might be for the opening of a building or something, or a royal occasion, or whatever it is. But if you don't know any of that, it's very difficult to try and figure out what's going on. But I would insist that it is an act of generosity, and therefore give the composer the benefit of the doubt that they are trying to say something. But they're trying to say it in a language other than verbal. So what might that be? Well, it's a vast topic. I've just got a few things to throw out. Hopefully you'll begin to see what on earth this bloke is on about. And if you don't, it doesn't matter because I don't live here and this isn't my church. Now, if you listen to Baroque music, some of it is purely abstract. You know, a Bach or Vivaldi concerto or something. There's a glorious sort of precision to it, and there's sort of rhythm, and there's sort of emotions, but they're often, not always, and in fact, less often than you might think, there is a sort of general feeling going on, but you can't really sort of nail it down further than that. So it can be very abstract. But what is interesting in the 19th century particularly, there were moments earlier too, of course, and then certainly on, is the emergence of what has been called program music. Basically, the idea behind program music is that it is music written in order to fulfill or narrate a program, as an agenda, a narrative. And that this narrative, using music, is there to follow. Now, sometimes the composer might actually warn us what that program is. Sometimes they don't. But here's one or two interesting quotes. Here's a quote I've added since I did the slides, but this is from the composer Felix Mendelssohn. He said, "People usually complain that music is so ambiguous, and what they're supposed to think when they hear it is so unclear, while words are understood by everybody. But for me, it is the exact opposite. What the music I love expresses to me are thoughts not too indefinite for words, but rather too definite." It's whatever that piece is, that's the thing I'm trying to express. And I can't describe that in words. It's that piece. One of the other great sort of proponents of this was Franz Liszt. What a weird bloke he was. Quite a lot of weird people in music, but that's okay. Just listen to their music and just ignore the rest. So Liszt said this. He defined program music like this. It's any preface in intelligible language, as in verbal, added to a piece of instrumental music by means of which the composer intends, this is interesting, to guard the listener against a wrong poetical interpretation. That's not something you get away with today, the idea that there's a wrong interpretation. Ooh, heaven forbid. And to direct the listener's attention to the poetical idea of the whole or to a particular part of it. In other words, he wants to make sure that what he has in mind when composing a particular piece, you get. Liszt could be quite sort of pernickety about it, and he wasn't the only one. So another one, and I'm going to play you a little bit of very famous program music by Hector Berlioz, French composer. He was off his rocker as well. He had fun and games. And the Symphonie Fantastique, some of you may know, it's a weird kind of fever dream, the whole thing, and is about this obsessive love affair, and then ends up being marched to his execution on the Madame la Guillotine, basically it's the sort of romantic hero on steroids plus LSD, probably. I don't know about that combination, and I wouldn't want to speak directly to it, but this is the fourth movement, the Martial Supplice, so the march to the scaffold where he's going to go to his execution. And basically, the name of the movement tells us something that's going on in it. Okay, so I'm just going to play you a little excerpt, and you can hear, hopefully, what that is like. Thank you. So there's a sort of triumphant march to his execution. So he's the sort of great romantic Byronic hero, I guess, and he's going with dignity. And then that's just the fourth movement. There's a movement after that, after his execution, when he starts dancing with witches and devils, and that's obviously quite odd. And he tells us that that's going on in the fifth movement in case it hadn't occurred to us, which it probably wouldn't have done. But there's all kinds of things going on in that music, and he's telling us what to see visually. Sort of mentally, rather. You see visually anyway, don't you? But see mentally. So that's a famous example. Let me give you another one. Now, if you know this piece, don't say a word, but it's Richard Strauss's Alpine Symphony. And it's one of my favourite pieces. It was written in 1915. And it's not a symphony in a traditional sense, but it's an orchestral narrative, if you like, on the grandest scale. It lasts 50 minutes of solid music for 150 players and includes all kinds of absolutely important and necessary things like cowbells, wind machines, thunder machines. I mean, no self-respecting orchestra should ever leave home without a cowbell, I think. And basically, the point is he's narrating a day's walk. He was from Bavaria. He's narrating a day's walk in the Alps, and they start before dawn with some friends, and basically they're climbing up to the summit, and then they come back down and basically get home, and it's that glorious feeling, you know, you're sort of red-faced and hot, but it's been cold outside. You get home and sit in front of a warm fire and stuff, and you feel it's been a great day. So the Alpine Symphony basically is just a day climbing and returning home from a walk in the Alps. And the climbers start before dawn, and in the music, it's one of the most wonderful dawns in music. You can find lots of great dawns. This is one of the best. As the sun rises behind the Alps on the horizon, it's just epic. There's a storm during the walk, obviously, because, I mean, you've got to have that in 50 minutes. And there's a sense of the grandeur of the natural world. It's a wonderful piece of music. But there are 22 parts to this symphony, not quite movements, but sort of sections, and they'll often just flow one into the other. So I'm going to play you a couple of very short excerpts. And if you know it, as I say, don't say anything, but I'm going to play you these and see what you can see as you hear this music. So I'm not going to tell you what the program says, although actually Strauss wrote in the score above each section what is going on. But see if you can work out what this might be. So this is okay, short but sweet, and unexpectedly loud at the beginning, which is always good. Keeps me on my toes and you. So, thoughts? Birds?
Snow falling?
I mean, we are in the Alps, so it's not beyond realms of possibility. Giving a hug? Yes, like it. Yeah, good. That's allowed. Uh-huh. I didn't see where that voice came from, but do you want to say more about that? So the sort of energy and determination kind of thing. Okay, yeah, great. Water? Related to snow? A storm breaking? I wonder if if I hadn't said there's going to be a storm, if you would have heard a storm. So you're all very suggestive, but suggestible, is that the word? Digestible. No, that's not the word. If I tell you that out of 22, this is section 6 and 7, it's pretty early on, so they're still in the foothills. They haven't quite got to the summit, and it gets even better. So that's an anticipation of the hugs at the top. Basically, in the score, he describes it as a sparkling waterfall and an apparition. In other words, in the sort of the light as it's sort of refracted in the water, as it's spewing over the edge, there's a sort of sense of a person or something. Is it thing rather mysterious? So in a sense, the sort of Alice in Wonderland thing, that it's recognizable, but there's something a bit extra. Now, having told you that in his mind is a sparkling waterfall, when you hear it, with the flutes and piccolos and everything just sort of pouring over the edge and rippling down. I mean, that's exactly what they're doing in the music. So he's literally doing that to echo what the water is doing. Now, so in those two examples and many, many others, the composer has a sense of a journey, a progress, a story, a moment, and he or she actually wants to tell us what that is so that we don't miss it. But actually, that's fairly unusual. And sometimes composers will deliberately hold that back and just say, let this speak for itself and see what you make of it. And of course, it's like, you know, a novelist, after their novel gets, if it becomes widely read and is popular and stuff, a novelist will often say how actually it's really exciting to hear different interpretations, not the crazies, but sort of valid interpretations of their novels, because people see things that the creator doesn't see, but that they're legitimately there. I mean, I find that fascinating, and you sometimes hear this on, you know, Radio 4 Book Club or whatever it is. Someone will put something to a writer and they say, oh yes, I'd never thought of that, but I think you're right. So we're not saying there are absolutely hard and fast right, wrong meanings here. There can be a range. But my contention is, even if there isn't specifically a program, a composer is wanting to say something. Because why else would they spend literally days just crafting black dots on lines? I mean, it's almost as mindless as it gets as an activity, unless you are doing this for the end of saying something. One of my absolute heroes, just as a human being, but also as a musician, is Shostakovich. I would love to spend all day talking about him. I think he was just a remarkable man. He wasn't a believer. He was actually asked once, I mean, many times actually, do you believe in God? He says, I don't, but I'm sad about that. His adult life began, so I think he was 18, more or less exactly the point that Stalin came to power. Basically, the people who loomed like huge Goliaths in his life. Anyway, there's a lot I could say about him, but we don't have time. But he wrote a lot of what you might call pure music. Music that doesn't have a program or a narrative. But it said bucket loads. But he said this, meaning in music, that must sound very strange for most people, particularly in the West. It's here in Russia that the question is usually posed. What was the composer trying to say, after all, with this musical work? What was he trying to make clear? The questions are naive, of course, but despite their naivety and crudity, they definitely merit being asked. And I would add to them, for instance, can music attack evil? Can it make man stop and think? Can it cry out and thereby draw man's attention to various vile acts to which he has grown accustomed, to the things he passes without any interest? I don't know exactly when he wrote that, but there were a number of points in his life when he wrote actually what were very dangerous things to write in communist Russia. Even after actually he'd been through some very terrible experiences, and there were times when he was absolutely convinced in his own mind he was going to end up in the gulag or worse. Julian Barnes has written an extraordinary novel about that experience of Shostakovich night after night waiting in the sort of landing outside his apartment. His family had gone to bed and he's there with his overnight bag waiting to be arrested, and he's outside so that it doesn't wake the family. Can music attack evil? That sounds mad. But I strongly believe that actually at some of his greatest moments, that's exactly what Shostakovich was doing. Many people, it's controversial, regard him as a sort of communist stooge, and he did join the party, and at great personal cost. He was in the Duma, the Russian parliament, under communism at the end of his life. There's all kinds of things to say about that. But I'm pretty convinced that he subverted things again and again and again. And it can make people stop and think. And actually, he did with music. He could say things that were unsayable with words. And if you're not into music or you haven't studied it or it's a sort of whole alien thing, if you just, you know, your main diet is pop music. I believe pop music can do it too. I'm not dissing pop music at all. But if that is your main diet, it's going to be even more conceivable than somebody who is listening frequently to Radio 3 or Classic FM. Even then, it has this power to stop people in their tracks and to shake them by the collar and say, listen, wake up. And actually, just it feels, I don't know about you, but the last week, the world has felt much more unstable. And actually, the seeds of it have been there for a number of years. And it's not going back to how it was 5 years ago. It's not. It's different now. It really is. And there are lots of ways you can see this. And it may well be that using words is going to get harder and harder. And I'm not just talking about being cancelled. I'm talking about getting a voice heard to stop people in their tracks. Maybe we're going to have to start revisiting some of this stuff in our culture. Well, what I want to talk about now is a couple of experiments a few of us have tried where we try to use music to do something more than just simply entertain or pass an evening. So you may not be aware, but for nearly 10 years, I was on the ministry team of All Souls Langham Place in London. And like Cambridge, London is full of amazing musicians. We were 15 minutes walk from the Royal Academy, so we had quite a lot of Academy students come to our church. And of course, you've got all the opera houses, and the number of orchestras in London is extraordinary. Still, it's dicey how sustainable musical London is for the future. I worry about that. Anyway, there's a lot of music going on still, just. And so there are a lot of very talented people around. And Robin, who was a retired lecturer in music, and his hobby was to make symphonic transcriptions for piano. Now, you can buy those, but he actually enjoyed the challenge of doing his own. So he would, you know, he would take a symphony that he loved, and he would work on it for maybe a few months, and he would transcribe it for either two hands or four hands. That means, four hands means two people. It's not that there are some very strange people in London. And, you know, you either do it for four hands on one keyboard or four hands on two. And it's particularly fun if you can get two pianos together, especially if they're in tune with each other. That's good. Because then it just gives a bit more volume to the sound. But otherwise, you're on one keyboard, so one person is the lower half and the other person is the upper half. And Robin basically would love doing this, and he was the one who suggested that we might try and use this. Now, All Souls would have, you know, we would have a mission week every 3 years, 2 or 3 years. We did one in the Olympics year and so on. And one of the things we're always trying to do is to get things out from the centre, mainly because the vast proportion of the congregation didn't live near All Souls. Most people commuted in, probably passing a lot of good churches on the way, but that's another story. And so the idea that people were going to come into the centre of London midweek, it just wasn't going to happen. You either did it early evening before people had left work, if they worked in W1, or you did stuff around and about. And so we were always scratching our heads. How can we do things that are accessible? And so Robin said, well, look, why don't we do actually what people more than 100 years ago always did if they wanted to hear new music? They would have a soiree at home, maybe 10, 15 people, as many as they could squeeze into the front room. And people would just, you know, somebody would buy the latest transcript of a Beethoven symphony or Schubert or whatever it was, and they would learn it, and then they'd get their friends round to hear. That's the only way 95% of people heard new music. There was no other way. The concerts were in one sort of central place. Most people didn't live near them. They couldn't afford it. It just didn't happen. I mean, we are so spoiled by how accessible music is, let alone how free it is. That's a whole other story too. But there was something rather lovely about recreating the way most people 150 years ago heard music, which was in the home with friends over a meal, perhaps. And so we recreated this. So there's another very good pianist in the church called Craig, who had studied music here, and he was on our staff team working with the kids' work and music. And so the two of them would play these symphonies, and we'd work out a program together. And basically, I would give a talk at some point in the evening, both to explain the music, but also to use it as a very sort of low-key, soft, evangelistic thing. To say that actually this music is more than just something that is nice to listen to, but it has meaning. Now, the first time I did this and played it and sung stuff, but I hadn't ever studied it. But Robin was really helpful. I did a lot of reading and I bounced ideas off the both of them. And we did this twice. So the first one in that first mission year, we call it an evening of Brahms. And we would offer a package, and several home groups took it up, and we went to their home, and it was very easy. And actually, people loved being invited. You know, come round next Tuesday evening and hear a symphony being played on our piano. Oh, and have a glass of wine and have someone explain it. It was great. People were really happy to be there, and they knew that it was Christian. And so 3 years later, we did the same thing. This time, we focused on the Soviet Union, and we focused on Prokofiev. So the first one, we did Brahms' 4th symphony, and then the second time, we did Prokofiev's 7th. So what I'm going to try and do is just give you a little taste of what I was trying to do with both of those. It's not the whole thing, but it just gives you an idea to say, look, here is something that might provoke people to think a bit. Well, Prokofiev had some weird religious views. It's hard to pin down exactly where he was spiritually. But Brahms was definitely not a believer. One of his kind of closed Brahms was to spiritual things. And so one of the things I was thinking about with the 4th Symphony is, you know, this was his last major work. And he didn't compose anything after this for many years. He had a sort of final burst right at the end. But basically, this was his last big statement. Brahms lived with the shadow of Beethoven over him the whole time, because everybody was always comparing him to Beethoven, and it was just like this curse over him. But in the fourth movement of this 4th symphony, so the last movement, which is, if you like, the last word, basically, it's like, after this, I've got nothing left to say. What you have in it is a sense of, well, I called it rage. It's a movement of rage. It's very sort of, it draws you in, it overwhelms, it's very visceral, but in a 19th century way. You may have heard sort of 20th century music that rages, and at times maybe you think hardly justifies the term music. You know, we're back to sort of new uses, is what's called a passacaglia, which basically is a motif, a theme, a sort of a melody or a sequence of notes that gets repeated. It comes from the Spanish, meaning, you know, it's walking down the street. And basically there is this repeated motif in the bass, the bottom of the orchestra. It changes instruments, but it is kind of, most of the time, there's a gap when you don't hear it, and it seems like things are brightening up, the sun's coming out, but then it's back. So I just isolated it on the piano. This is that motif. Now, even by itself, it sounds a bit sinister, perhaps. There's something looming, and, you know, you could see how that might be used and adapted and developed, you know, maybe for a horror movie or something. That, you know, there's something around the corner or something looming. Even that. Now, when you have that repeated again and again and again at different speeds, but the same notation, and again, it just really gets under your skin, and that's the point. And so when we played the whole symphony in one go, so I was giving people, they had a handout, they could see the different parts. I gave them things to look out for in each movement. This is what one of the things to look out for in the last movement. But I got them to think about a couple of poems, which I printed on the sheet as well. So there was Dylan Thomas's famous one, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. There is something about our mortality that is wrong." And I don't think it's a stretch to say that that is the ultimate thing that Brahms is raging against. But it is inescapable. There are moments when there's relief, but then it comes back. The final enemy, the ultimate enemy. Now, I discovered after one of these evenings that there was a woman there who actually was doing a PhD on Brahms symphonies, which was an absolute nightmare, but fortunately, I only found her afterwards. But here's the good news, she agreed with me, so that was a result. But I got them to think about this poem by Edward Shillitoe from The Trenches of the First World War. Oops, sorry, it's done that again. I forget where I put follow on and on click, you know how it is. So this is the poem, I'll put it up, and the music will come. And this is about mortality, but it's written in the trenches by a padre, a chaplain, who was there, called Jesus of the Scars. And basically, the assumption I was making is that death is our enemy, and that's what we all have in common. The issue is, do you rage against it with futility, as Dylan Thomas and Brahms do, or can you look at it square in the face and say, actually, there's more we can say? And obviously, because I'm a Christian, I think there is. Okay, so I'm going to pause. Thank you. fascinating thing about that Passacaglia motif is that it's there pretty much the whole time, even when you can't hear it in the basses, even when it's lyrical, that gorgeous flute solo. It's there in the fabric of the harmonies. I hate the flute. I used to play it badly. I think it's wrong, and it shouldn't be allowed. But there, I think it's okay. Let that be a lesson to you. Anyway, I find that visceral. Yes, it's of its time, but it's agony when you think he had nothing to add to this, really, for years. And it's over in a flash. But that's life. Do you remember those books, The Bluffer's Guides? I think, you know, they're still around. The Bluffer's Guide to Music is a lot of fun. I particularly love the little entry for Brahms. Because basically, you know, if you don't know anything about it, if somebody says Brahms, you just need to go, ah, Brahms. And they think, oh, yeah, you know what you're talking about. So now you know, ah, Brahms. Okay? Ready? One, two, three. Ah, marvellous. Okay, good. Can you let me go over 5 minutes? Where's Angelina? Thank you very much. She says yes. No? No, yes, yes, yes. Yeah, you can. If you need to go, go. I don't mind. I want to talk about Prokofiev briefly. His Seventh Symphony, again, was his last symphony. He, by 1951, 1952, he is 60. And some of his fellow composers, and Shostakovich was one of them, thought he was a fool. They respected him musically, but he was a fool because he was had been living in the West, in Paris and in the States, and Stalin was coaxing him back to the Soviet Union, and he coaxed him with, you know, the promise of an amazing tour, sell-out concerts all around the Soviet Union, and he'd be fated as, you know, the sort of the prodigal come home. Stravinsky was the sort of the model, if you like, of the Russian who's fled. And, you know, he completely turned his back on the communist revolution and everything else. And he spent most of his life in the West, in America. But there was a sort of great propaganda coup in getting Prokofiev back. So he went back. And true to Stalin's word, he was fated wherever he went. Had the most amazing tour. And then he went back to the States. And then Stalin said, look, come again and we'll do the same. And he came, his passport was removed, and he never left. And he died in poverty in Moscow. And it was miserable and wretched. Weirdly, he died on the very same day as Stalin. But the world didn't hear about it for 3 or 4 days because, obviously, Uncle Joe's death eclipsed everything. One of his close friends was then a young cellist by the name of Rostropovich, one of the greatest cellists who's ever lived. Rostropovich was appalled. He went to visit him in his apartment in Moscow, couldn't believe by the state of his health and his circumstances. And he described in his diary that Prokofiev was close to hunger. And the only hope for earning money was to win the Stalin Prize, particularly the gold prize. That was worth 10,000 rubles. And so basically these sort of baubles were a lifeline for people. And so Prokofiev knew if he was going to get any money, he had to win the gold prize. And he was working on his Seventh Symphony. He'd actually been commissioned to write a children's symphony. In his Sixth Symphony, before he'd articulated some of the horrors of the Second World War, or as in the Soviet Union it was known as the Great War, we in the West have no clue as to what the Soviet Union suffered in the Second World War. Our sufferings in the West pale. They lost millions, as well as all the sort of consequences of the war. And so, you know, we don't know what we're talking about, really, on our side of what became the Iron Curtain. Many composers, therefore, were, is inspired the right word, propelled to articulate the suffering in music. And Prokofiev had done that in the Sixth Symphony, so you couldn't really do that again. And the great dilemma for all musicians in the Soviet Union is to walk the tightrope between keeping your artistic and creative integrity and eating and not going to the gulag. And it's very easy to judge and to condemn from the outside about what compromises or sort of choices people made or shouldn't have made. Well, Prokofiev was starving and ill. And what is fascinating about the Seventh Symphony is that there are two endings. There is the official end and his own ending. And they both exist now. The personal, the real ending was secret. And he gave it to Rostropovich to protect until such a time as it might be possible to play it. So I'm going to play you just the official ending, which indeed did win the Stalin Gold Prize that year and got him his 10,000 rubles. So this is the official ending. Isn't that lovely? What do you make of that? Just, I mean, you don't know any context, you haven't heard the rest of it. This is the end of the fourth movement. There we are. Say again?
Neat and tidy.
Neat and tidy, very, yeah, absolutely. They all live. Yep, absolutely. It's kind of sort of, you know, with a bow on top. It feels very Disney and fake. I don't think I'm putting words into your minds. It feels very artificial and cursory and just, well, I'm just going to get this done. If you listen to the whole thing, it just comes out of the blue. I mean, a lot of the fourth movement is as it remains in the real ending, and I'm going to play you the fourth movement as we finish. But this just suddenly comes, and it's just like, right, well, I've had enough. There we are. Bang, gone. It wins the prize. And basically, it was towing the line. Because socialist realist music, like socialist realist painting and writing and pretty much everything else, yes, you can engage with suffering, but you must always overcome it because of the golden future that awaits us in making true, pure communism in this glorious paradise that is to come. And so, basically, he writes this official ending in order to eat. But he said to Rostropovich, he said, "But Slava, you will live much longer than I, and you must take care that this new ending never exists after me." To his wife Mira's distress, she found him each morning more and more depressed. When she asked if he felt pain everywhere, he told her, "My soul hurts." And he dies, as I say, on the same day as Stalin. I think one of the things that's going on in this symphony is a big symphony. There are four movements. Each has different elements. You need to listen to the thing for yourself to sort of get a sense of it. There's a lot of nostalgia. There are moments where he seems to be harking back to the glory days of Tchaikovsky and, you know, sort of Russian imperial court. And, you know, it's a kind of picture book, sort of idealized golden age view of the past. And the contrast with him in his dingy Moscow apartment, desperate for food, couldn't be greater. There's real pathos. There's a sense of time, though. And there's a ticking clock that you hear on the Glocks, the Glockenspiels, and it's relentless. And it's there in the first movement, and it comes back at the end of the fourth movement. We're going to listen to that. And basically, one of the things that really strikes me about this is a kind of longing for justice. Prokofiev did believe in the transcendent. Quite what is hard to... It was a sort of mishmash of lots of different things. You know, Russian Orthodoxy, of course, but other things as well. I'm not an expert by any means enough to know exactly what's going on there. But he did believe in something, and there was just this yearning for something more that could actually both make sense of all of this and put right the wrongs. Because as I often come back to this point, Stalin died in his bed. The dilemma of the Second World War is Stalin or Hitler was going to win. So which do you choose? One of them was going to win. You know, talk about sort of the devil's choice. He died in his bed, albeit one of about eight, because he moved around to stop people assassinating him. But he died in his bed. He got away with genocide. He got away with it. Unless there is a God of justice. And I think Prokofiev is yearning for that. But what is so tragic about this is far from having this Disney bow-tied ending, it just peters out. And is gone. And he has nothing left to say. He's exhausted. And I find it deeply affecting. And okay, let's listen. This is the fourth movement, and then I will finish.
Having a jolly time. I hope you're having a jolly time.
Thank you.
Romeo and Juliet.
There are little echoes of the ballet there.
He died not long after. My soul hurts. It's there.
Thank you so much, Mark. No regrets for extending to listen to that piece. But we have now gone over and through question and answer time. So I'm sorry, but I don't want to say too much more because I feel like we should end on that note, literally. And if you do have any questions, maybe Mark's around for a minute or two after. So shall I just say a prayer for us as we close? Father, we thank you for what we've just listened to this last hour or so. We thank you for the beauty and complexity of your creation, how when we look at it closer, how when we listen closely to music, we just find more and more layers. We thank you, Lord, from Hannah. We thank you for our wonderful band and the way that we can enjoy music together in so many different ways as your people, giving you praise. We pray that you'd be with us as we reflect on what we've heard today, and that you'd bring more music into our lives, that we'd help each other enjoy it to your glory. Amen.